Today, let's talk about when to improve a crop. That is, how Christians can make better fruit.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So to start this conversation, I have to bring up something painful to me, and that's the way people react when I start to talk about philosophy or ethics. This is a major issue for me, obviously. That's my education is in this world. I wrote my dissertation on a topic about ethics. I care about the issues deeply, and it's where my mind works all the time. I didn't find out until I was in my first graduate degree. That philosophy is the area where people talk about the things that I've thought about my whole life and couldn't figure out why nobody cared about it, why nobody else talked about it. So I love talking about philosophy and ethics, and yet the natural reaction that people give is similar to the line that people use about people who do other things like philosophy. So, you know, there are people who will describe someone who prays all the time or who is super spiritual. They'll say, you know, that guy is so heavenly minded, he's no earthly good. That's a line I learned a long time ago in my fundamentalist tradition that I was in for a good while. And I get the line. I mean, I understand it. He's so focused on spirituality and stuff, he never applies himself to actually do anybody any good. So heavenly-minded, he's no earthly good. It's a similar thing when you describe someone as being an ivory tower scholar. They're not ever connected to the real world, and they're theorizing about things that don't make any difference. They're a navel gazer. You know, they're just staring at their belly button all the time. And who cares? The stuff that they're talking about doesn't actually change anything in the real world. Who gets to eat a meal because you think these things, right? Well, the reality is those things change the entire world of who can eat a meal or who can't eat a meal. But getting there is a fairly long journey. And basically, by its nature, philosophy, which can pretty much be described this way, it's asking questions about what everyone else ignores or assumes they already know. That's what philosophy does. It examines those things. And so it only makes sense if that's the case. If I'm saying up front, I want to ask questions about what everyone else doesn't care about or believes they already know and don't need to ask questions about, then it shouldn't surprise me that the natural reaction to my studying those things that people would say, why on earth are you asking that? We already know the answer to that question. And yet, there is a reason that it's important to ask those fundamental, those basic foundational philosophical or ethical, theoretical types of questions. And when I'm actually teaching this in a philosophy class, like an introduction to philosophy class, I point out that René Descartes, you know, he says at one point, he was never able to do decent philosophy until he was an older man because he had to pay the bills and he had to feed himself and, you know, have a life. And some people would use that as evidence for not doing the philosophy at all. But my response to that, and I say this to my classes all the time, is, I mean, it's true that in common sense and just practical daily living, you can put food on the table. But it's also true that using that approach, we would still think the world was flat. And it's been helpful realizing that the world is not flat, except for those few people who have a hard time acknowledging that it's not flat. And it may not change how you build a house, but it does change how we communicate around the world today and the entire economy and how it functions now. So anyway, all that said, so the parallels that I would give to the importance of dealing with topics that might seem uninteresting, dull, pedantic in a given moment, but are actually critically important. Two examples I'll give. You know, one is on the less trivial side, and it has to do with gun safety. you know, so when you're teaching a person how to handle a gun and try to be careful, I'm not a gun expert, so don't take anything I say as instruction on how to handle a gun. I have guns. I use them wisely, I think, and all that kind of stuff. But I'm certainly not an instructor. So this is just me talking off the top of my head about a news story that happened 30 years ago. On gun safety, you know, you establish some basic rules. And so when you're teaching somebody this, they're like, yeah, but when can I shoot the gun? Well, you know, when can I finally pull the trigger or whatever? Or other people buy a gun for home safety, and you're saying, hey, I want you to go take this course, or I want you to read this material, or let's have a conversation about how we're going to use this and how we're not going to use it. And they're like, yeah, whatever. I mean, I'm just using it for home safety. I'm just going to put it in the drawer and not worry about it. But, you know, establishing a basic rule, some theoretical guideline for when you do or don't use a gun can make a huge difference. Here's a very basic, simple rule. Don't shoot something if you can't see it, right? So don't just shoot into the dark and hope you're shooting the right thing. Otherwise, when you're in the deer blind and you see something moving in the bush and you're on the hungry side or the bored side, as a lot of people are, in that moment, you're looking at the bush and you're like, oh, I think it may be a buck. It may be a deer. It may be something I could. And then you shoot. And then find out you shot your hunting buddy or you shot someone else who you just couldn't see through the bush. And you can say, oh, nobody would ever do that. You know it happens all the time. Happens all the time. Well, I know I saw a deer earlier, and now that bush is moving. I think I got to shoot. I can't give up the hunt. You should have a rule that you've established ahead of time. And this turns into a tragic circumstance in the example I was giving about having a gun in the home for protection. Decades ago, really, back in the early 2000s, so probably 20 years ago now, I remember hearing the story in the mid-cities of a man who woke up in the middle of the night to someone who had broken into the house and was walking through the hall, and he got up and he went out, and there's this dark figure in the hall coming toward him, and he shoots him. And it's his son who had come home without telling him. It was just a horrible tragedy, and I don't mean to even drag that up to abuse it. I'm just pointing out that unless you set the rules ahead of time, the circumstance of the moment will drive you to do something that you wouldn't do otherwise, that you should know better than to do. And the reason you establish those rules ahead of time, the reason you think about it when it doesn't matter, is because when it does matter, you may not have the time or clarity to think about it correctly or to make the right judgment in that moment. A more trivial example, let me give you a more trivial example. In skiing, I used to take youth groups skiing when I was a pastor because I enjoyed skiing, you know, and it's an excuse to go ski. And so we took our youth group skiing, and this one particular girl, her name was Monica, she had not skied before. And so we went up this mountain. I had not been up this mountain before. The place where we were going to ski didn't have snow, so we went to a strange mountain. And for those of you who ski often, you know that makes a difference. You know all the slopes if you've been somewhere before. We didn't know all these slopes. So we went up the mountain. We got to this one point where this girl had never skied before. I mean, she was on skis for the very first time. She's pretty coordinated, and she was going to be okay. And we had a group, and so we thought, well, it'll work out. We'll help her. And we had people who'd skied a lot, so they were going to help this group of skiers get down for the first time. But we ended up in this place where at least for one short little run, you had to be on what it's called a blue ski run. So the whites are super easy. You know, the blues are kind of hard and the blacks are very difficult. The blues are not hard at all for somebody who skis a lot, but for people who don't, it's just deadly. I mean, it could be deadly. So there's this blue run from one lift to the other that's going to give us all the green. I said white a minute ago, green runs that would make it super easy to ski down the mountain with these beginners. So it's like, okay, we're going to help you guys get down here. Some of them are just going to hike down. But this one girl, Monica, she decides she's going to put her skis on and she's going to go down the blue with us. And so we're saying, okay, well, listen, you need to do this carefully. You need to turn sideways, and here's what you do. And just in case your skis get out from under you, you start going faster than you want to go. Make sure you think about it now. Make a big pie and push out. Or if you can't do that, then turn into the mountain. Don't turn down with the mountain. Turn into the mountain. Or if you can't make that happen, fall over side. We're saying all this, and she's like, no, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. And she just takes off. And she starts going down. And she hears us telling her, just fall down if you can't. And she's starting to fly down the mountain. And it's a short run. Thank heavens, a short run. But she starts flying down the mountain. And she hears us telling her to fall down. So she sits down, which means your skis are still under you if you sit down on skis. And this blue run had a lot of moguls on it. So, you know, a lot of bumps on it is what those are. And so she's sitting on her skis, I mean, flying down this short run, bouncing in the air between sitting and just flailing in the air and then sitting again and flailing. And finally she gets to the bottom and sort of tumbles to a stop and laughs it off and everything's good and fine, thank heavens. But I mean, at that speed, if she'd hit a tree or run into a post or anything in the way, it would have been deadly. And it was just because we didn't take time at the moment. I say we, it's her fault. Anyway, I know this is always the sponsor's fault. But the point is, you have to take time to get the theory under you because in the moment, you don't know what to do. Oh, sit down. No. Let's practice one time. Fall over sideways. That's different than sitting down. That would have made all the difference in that moment. And I really was. I was terrified we were going to have a dead youth on our hand in that moment. And the fact that we didn't isn't because we had control of the situation. We were just blessed by God or lucky, whichever word you want to put on it. We had the providence of Ruth in that moment, so to speak. So anyway, you get the idea. So it's important to think about things ahead of time. And that's why, as we start thinking about, you know, what's the right thing for us to do in a society that's trying to pass laws? What's the right thing for me to do when I'm faced with a dilemma between telling the truth and causing some harm or telling a little lie but being able to solve the problem? How do I deal with those things? How do I resolve these issues? And I'm not even talking about any particular issues today. At the end, we'll give a couple of examples just to talk about how important it is that we think theory first. But it's not that I want to solve issues today or address stories that are going on right now. I don't even want to teach a particular ethical theory today. I want us to talk about why having a theory, why having these deeper understandings of what's right and wrong, what's important and not important, is so important for us as believers and as people who are going to live in a society together. And in laying that down, recognize that even if we do disagree on the theories themselves, it won't keep us from being able to function together as a society if we have thought through these ideas beforehand. So theories themselves, even the deep underlying rationale for why we do what we're going to do, the theories themselves may be built on a common foundation, which means that even if the theories are different, they could end up looking a lot alike. So there are theories and ethics that are diametrically opposed to each other. And I'll give some examples of this in a moment. But there are some theories and ethics that are just completely the opposite of each other. I've mentioned this before, utilitarianism, you know, a sort of a pragmatic approach to ethics, and I know those are two different things, but they're closely related, sort of a pragmatic approach to ethics, you know, figure out what's going to produce the best result, and that's the right thing to do. So, you know, what's going to save the most lives or what's going to bring about the best solution for this problem, whatever. When you look at ethics that way, that's called utilitarianism. You're trying to get to the good, and whatever the means is that gets to the good, that's what makes it right. The end justifies the means. Deontology, or duty-based ethics, which is about what you're supposed to do, that's what defines what's right, what you're supposed to do, not what the result is, what the result that you're trying to get. It's defined the opposite as utilitarianism. In deontology, or in duty-based ethics, the whole nature of the ethic is to say the ends never justify the means. The fact that you were able to make someone else feel better by doing this or solve some problem by telling a lie doesn't make lying right, ever. Lying is always wrong, no matter what. In deontology, you have a completely different statement. Ends never justify means. Then you have in utilitarianism, which says, well, the ends do justify the means. They explain what the means are that you ought to use. They actually prescribe the means that you ought to use to get there. Those are completely opposite ethical theories. And yet, there is a commonality in their foundation that makes a lot of their conclusions identical. Now, again, doesn't make all their conclusions the same, and theories do matter in the practical outcome that you get when you're looking at certain issues, but they also do merge over the interest, for instance, in those two ethics, in utilitarianism as it was developed by John Stuart Mill and other theorists like David Hume, in utilitarianism and in duty-based ethics or deontology, like developed by Kant and a bunch of other ethicists, this sort of rational approach to things, both put an incredible value on the individual, which I'll come back to and explain more of in just a moment. So the fact that even if theories are different, they could be built on, in this case, a common appreciation for every person in a society. That fact means that you could, even with different theories, arrive at conclusions that are compatible with each other, with the ability to live in a society together, even with your different theories. I'm saying all of that because a lot of times when you start working on, and this happens with religion, it happens with Christianity, that people will say, I had accusations made about Christianity this way when I was a young pastor. I would have atheist friends that I had that would say, well, you know, if you'd give up your Christianity, we could eliminate a lot of the evils in the world. I mean, look at the Crusades and all the other evils that Christianity has brought about because of these crazy commitments to religious doctrines that make people do terrible things to other people and then justify it in the name of eternity, ignoring the evils that are perpetrated in this world. They would say, by the way, I would always respond to that by saying, yeah, I don't think religion had a lot to do with why Stalin was guilty of killing up to 30 million of his own people. So there's a lot of evil to go around, whatever the foundation of it is. But those same people would be able to say, yeah, but Stalin's commitment to communism, Stalin's commitment to a particular theory of how the world ought to function did shape his willingness to sacrifice other people's lives. And so there's a legitimate concern that the more you theorize, the more you back away from the practical application of things, the more you might develop a really bad theory. And in that bad theory, describe some actions, make some decisions about particular, I want to use the word instantiations here, you might actually apply things in a certain way that really could be destructive to people. That's true, but it's not necessary. To theorize well, to do it well, might even bring us to different conclusions about which theory we're going to use, but it can bring us to a place where we can solve problems we will never address in the way we're trying to solve them right now, which is on the wrong end of the issues that come up. And I'll get to more of that in just a moment. So for one thing, different theories may agree on certain essentials. That's what I was getting at there. Let me give you a couple of examples, specific examples, of how those theories could share the same essentials. So in the first case, the example would be theories about why people care about doing what's right. Not defining what's right or wrong, but just saying, here's why people come to care about ethics at all. And this actually matters when you're trying to develop a theory about what people ought to do or what people ought to value, but it is more foundational than that. It's sort of psychological. So on the naturalistic side, by naturalistic, I mean just ascribing everything to nature itself, not to God, not to some supernatural intervention or something spiritual or unmeasurable, but using nature and observations of nature, so sort of an empirical method. And I'm using Thomas Hobbes as a background here for doing this. So using that kind of approach to this, if you're explaining why is it that people want to do what's right? I mean, if we had a very often I'll hear Christians say or make a case for the idea that if the world were completely naturalistic, if there were no God and if there were no conscience that God had built into people supernaturally, then it would just be a Nietzschean world of power with people struggling against each other and trying to whatever. But Hobbes actually has a reasonable theory from the start, and this is long before evolution is a theory, a specific theory, like, you know, with Darwin. So a couple of hundred years before that is even an option. Hobbes is already more like 250 years. Hobbes is already arguing that the foundation for why people want to do what's right and wrong is completely naturalistic. It just develops in the human mind the same way it would in an animal. And that is, you have stimuli like pain and pleasure. And pain and pleasure are just neutral stimuli that happen all the time. Ooh, don't touch that, you know, don't whatever. But those become associated with behaviors. So once you start doing a certain thing and it brings pain, or once you start doing another thing and it brings pleasure, then you start associating pain and pleasure with punishments and rewards. And that starts shaping your behaviors. And over time, you stop thinking specifically in terms of the reward or the punishment that might come because you tell a lie or you bully someone in the sand, you know, in the sand pit for their toy. You stop doing that and you internalize it. And it becomes a habit or a preference based on the reward or the lack of pain that you got from it or whatever. And by the way, and this in Hobbes, this just develops more and more until you arrive at a social contract. The idea being that one pleasure that we wouldn't count as a pleasure, but I mean, it's a fully complex and integrated, internalized kind of pleasure, not to borrow Freud's sense of internalizing things, but that is the basic idea, is being a part of a society in which people keep their promises even to their own hurt. That is, it's worth so much to us that other people keep their promises to us, regardless of what it might cost them to do it, that we're actually eventually willing to keep our promises to other people, even when it causes us problems. That question, why do people keep promises, even when it hurts them? You know, why does a person who's in a military brigade, why does he jump on a hand grenade to save his buddy's lives? It just seems like that doesn't make sense in a naturalistic world. But for Thomas Hobbes, he's explaining it away, saying, well, it's because your psychology developed in a way that said you value being part of a society in which people keep their promises to each other, even when it's their own personal disadvantage, that you yourself are willing to be that kind of person in order to be in that kind of society. So we keep promises for the benefit of society, even to our own disadvantage, because the pleasure, which is highly abstract and complex, of being part of such a society is greater than the pleasure of breaking our promise in the moment. But there is a different, completely different theoretical way of explaining that for those of us who are not naturalists, but think of it more theologically. And by the way, I'll give this example from Romans 2. I think Romans 2 explains perfectly how God puts in every person's conscience, heart, this sense of what's right and wrong and a commitment to doing it. But I do believe it's supernatural. I believe God creates us this way. And he uses society and all the pressures that are there and all the things that go with it in order to cement that into us or to multiply its presence in our lives. So in Romans 2, the passage I'm talking about, which I'm sure you know, starts in verse 12. Look, everyone, and this is Paul saying, this is true about people who don't have a written law. They didn't learn from Moses the commandments that God gave on Sinai, and they don't have the Jewish Torah to work from. But instead, he says, all who have sinned, because he is going to describe everyone as having sinned, of course, Paul is theologically, all who have sinned, even without a law, anomos, without the law, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. Why would they perish? They didn't have any commandment they broke, right? No, he's not going to say that. He's going to say they do have a commandment. And all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law, for it's not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. That's a great logical argument, by the way, but that's not the point for today. Verse 14 is where it picks up for us when he says, for, and this is in Romans 2 again if you're trying to look it up, for when Gentiles who do not have the law, so they're anomos, they're without law. By nature, though, they do what the law requires, so they tell the truth, they love their child, they pay their debts, they do whatever it is in nature, just without the law, but in their society, they just do these things that we would consider moral, but also that the law says you're supposed to do. When they do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves. Now, he could mean two different things by that. They are defining the law for themselves in a relativistic sense, or they are evidence in their own behavior that they do have the law of God. And it's the second, the fact that they do have the law of God, that is Paul's point because of what he's about to say. I'm not speculating about it. As the passage goes on, that becomes clear. He says, they become a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law, meaning the written law that the Jews have. Why is that? They show the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also, in addition to this law that God has written on their hearts, their conscience also bears witness. And the arguments they have among themselves or the way they describe things in their society among themselves, or it might be internalized to the individual He says their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. His point is their knowledge of the law, their awareness that there's something right or wrong in the world for them to do, and they should do what's right and shouldn't do what's wrong, and so on. It's not rooted in an explicit command like God put on the stones and gave to Moses and gave to the Jews in their tradition, but instead is written on their hearts and evidenced in their conscience and in their dialectics in their society about what's right and wrong. It's all evidence that they do have a moral compass to begin with, and compass is probably a loose term for what they have, that God has provided them. Even though it's not rooted in explicit command, it is rooted in an implicit awareness that they have. The only reason I brought that up is to give a contrast to what Thomas Hobbes was giving as an explanation for why everybody everywhere has this way of behaving morally, which doesn't seem like it would make sense if you were trying to describe the world naturalistically. And so Thomas Hobbes says, well, let me make sense of it for you. Here's a theory about why people behave morally in society. And then there's Paul in the book of Romans explaining to them why people in a land who've never seen the law of God written on commandments, written on tablets given by, you know, God to Moses on Mount Sinai, why they do what's right. And it's completely different because God has written that law on their hearts. Completely different theories, and yet the same result, the same consequence that we recognize in the world, that people everywhere do have a moral sense. I'd love to have a little respite from the conversation we're having right now and take you on a journey through 20th century anthropology and sociology and the way people tried to say, well, no, there are some societies that don't have morality at all, but then a recognition by the late part of the 20th century, even by the most naturalistic sociologists, that in actuality, there is an ethic in every society. It just might be different. And by others, and this is an arguable claim, that actually that ethic is shared. It just might be shared at more of a meta or a higher level than at the specific instances of how you ought to do what's right and wrong. But I'm not going to take that respite. I know that felt like a respite to you, but no, it wasn't. That would have been 40 minutes long in itself if that were the respite. The point here is that there are examples of how theories about what people are doing might be different, and yet the essentials of it are the same. Everybody everywhere does have a moral sense, what's right and what's wrong, even if we disagree on what the theory is at the base of that. Another example, that some wildly different theories might share the same essential basis for considering what's right. And so this is parallel to the common ground discussion that we had from a previous episode about how we resolve public issues and how we present logical arguments, that when you're trying to make a case for something, you always have to find common ground because that's what the premises are in an argument. You can go back and listen to that in a previous episode another time. But the example that I would give today is more specific, using, again, Hobbes as a basis for this, and we could have done it with John Stuart Mill, but we'll take Thomas Hobbes, that his theory, his understanding of how we come to a moral sense or a moral compass, develop a moral compass, is based on selfishness and a naturalistic psychology, a psychological egoism. His theory is based on that. Well, because we want to avoid pain and we want to pursue pleasure, we end up with this psychology that makes us interested in keeping our promises even when it's to our own disadvantage, and therefore we develop a social contract with others and so on. That basis of naturalistic psychology is still all about a society which is respectful of others' rights and interests, despite the impediment those rights and interests might be to my own rights and interests in a certain situation. That's what Thomas Hobbes is trying to address by explaining this psychology and trying to figure out how a social contract would develop in light of that. Kant's theory, in contrast to Hobbes' theory, and Kant is no believer, he's no Christian. He was raised by Christians, so he's heavily influenced by it in his upbringing, but he's not a Christian at all. Kant's theory, in total contrast to Thomas Hobbes' theory, is based on abstracted reason, not empirical observation. It's based on universal intuitions and objective universal agreement about certain things. Completely the opposite of the empirical approach that Thomas Hobbes is trying to take. And yet, Kant ends up being entirely about living in a kingdom of ends. That phrase may not mean much to you, but it means living in a society respectful of others' rights and interests, their ends, despite the impediment those ends, those rights and interests, might be to my own rights and interests, my ends, in a given situation. That's exactly the same value that's underlying both of these theories. So in a couple of ways, you know, we've given examples of how theories might be wildly divergent and yet represent the same core value. And because of that, by the way, some of the outcomes can be compatible as well, even though the means of arriving at them could be completely different. In a funny way, this is what I see happening when parents just go ballistic lately. And I can say that as parent and grandparent now. And it's just math, so give me a minute to have a free swing here. When parents just go ballistic over the new way their students are being taught to solve math problems in the long run. And, you know, people who don't theorize about math at all and don't have any idea about number theory or anything else are just beside themselves because their kids are not being taught to do math the same way they were taught to do math when they were in school. And either because, whatever the reason, who cares about the motives, it's like, can you believe the math they're teaching in school these days? It's insane. I can't, you know, there's no respect for it and so on like that. And yet, the solutions end up being the same. Even though the theories are different, the commitment to being able to use logic and calculation and method and algorithms to solve complex problems by learning to apply it to simpler problems to begin with, all of that's the same. And so the outcomes end up obviously being the same or even better because the theory might be better. And yet, we find ourselves butting heads because we disagree about some portion along the way that we don't like. And so I just, you know, just another example to say, we need to develop a theory at the base of what we're doing. There are some things in those theories that are fundamentally important. That's what we need to start talking about. So a couple of fundamentals here, and these are, and I'm just choosing these randomly, and I mean that. If I were actually trying to talk theory in depth, we would approach this much, much more systematically, and it would be the whole conversation. But I just want to give a couple of examples, some fundamentals in ethics. These are going to apply to any theory we're going to develop. So for instance, when we're talking about doing the right thing, justice, ethics, whatever word you want to put on this whole complex of issues around morality and making good choices about what to do or what to value or so on, one of the things that's always going to be present in an ethic is that it's social. Ethics are social. So, for instance, we did an episode a while back on a text on Psalm 24. It was episode 31, I believe. You can find it at barrykramer.com. I encourage you to do it or wherever you get your podcasts. So anyway, the idea was we did Psalm 24. There was a similar Psalm, Psalm 15, that had these phrases in it that express who is regarded as righteous. Notice that every one of these phrases in Psalm 15 is about something social, even the ones that look like they're not. So for instance, it says, who's going to sojourn in your tent? Who's going to dwell in your holy hill? He who walks blamelessly and does what is righteous. Even the statement walks blamelessly implies a relationship with other people. Are others able to bring an accusation against you? Speaks truth, implies a relationship with others, words that are communicating in some way. But specifically, starting in verse 3 of chapter 15, he says, doesn't slander with his tongue, that's about other people, does no evil to his neighbor, who is another person, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, another person, in whose eyes a vile person, that's another person, is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. Those are other people. Who swears to his own hurt and does not change, that is, keeps a promise to other people, even when it's to a disadvantage to him in the moment. Who does not put out his money at interest to other people and doesn't take a bribe against the innocent, who are other people. He who does these things, he's the one who shall never be moved, who shall dwell on the holy hill of the Lord. That's in Psalm 15. Now, those are just examples, but it's making the point that ethics is inherently social. Even the things that seem to apply to us personally are about the kind of person we're supposed to be in our relations with others. Our ethics is always public. It's always social. And there is, obviously, there are things that we're doing in private that reveal the depth of the truth of who we actually are. But the point of those is that when we're in private, we're revealing who we ought to also be when we're in public, which is why the word hypocrite is such an important word in talking about Christian ethics. So they're always social. So the idea of social justice, even though it's a term that's applied to specific political movements right now, is actually a redundancy. I mean, justice is social. And we ought to start recognizing that again and making sure that we understand that whatever ethic we're going to be dealing with is going to have a social, not just component, but essential component to it. It's also, by the way, ethics is also foundational. That is, when you have justified something, and remember the word just and the word righteous or the word right are all inherently tied together. So in fact, in Hebrew and in Greek, the word just is the word righteous. The word justified is made righteous. It's the same word. There's none righteous means there's none just. So when you say you've justified something, you've declared it righteous. You've made it the right thing to do. When you have justified an act, when you've declared it the right thing to do, you've answered the final question about whether you ought to do it or not do it. That's the meaning of declaring it justified. Or in some theories, you would have fully answered the question of why it's not the wrong thing to do. Because, as we'll talk about in a moment, well, there's a limitation to what ethics actually tries to do. But there's nothing else to resolve about its value once you've done it. So ethics is sort of the ultimate declaration about acts or about character or about ends, goods that we're pursuing, depending on the theory that you use. Obviously, I'm a deontologist, so I think it's about the act. You know, do you do the right thing? Maybe that's not obvious to everyone, but I'm saying it to you so that anybody who's talked to me about ethics knows that I'm a deontologist. I know. It matters to me that I get to say things like that. But anyway, the point is that whatever the theory is, you've done everything that's necessary to decide, is this the thing I'm going to do or not? You don't do that and then bring in a bunch of other measures and then say, oh, yeah, I know this is the right thing to do, but instead I'm going to do that. If you do say that, if you say, well, I know that's the right thing to do, but instead I'm going to do this other thing, then in reality, you think the other thing is even more right. You think it is the better thing to do based on an ethic that you're not being honest with yourself about. You actually hold something else as more fundamental in establishing what is the right thing to do. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof the ways of death. That's a really important concept in terms of how we decide things. So it's foundational. Ethics is social. It's foundational. Ethics is universal. And this is sort of built into ethics. And by the way, this doesn't require you to be a Christian to say this. You don't even have to be religious to say this. The person who was most adamant about this claim regarding ethics in my dissertation committee when I was writing about ethics was a naturalist, an existentialist, a person who doesn't believe in God at all, doesn't believe there's anything spiritual or invisible out there. Well, not invisible makes the wrong point, but abstract sort of thing. He wouldn't reify those things. So so my point is that ethics is universal, and I think this is defensible, that even for a person who is a relativist, even if you think, oh, well, ethics is different for this culture and that culture, a cultural relativist, for instance, even for a person who's a relativist, the ethic that you hold completely, universally controls your responsibility to those others. And I could spend, again, all day talking about this example for why a cultural relativist would then still be stepping back to a meta-ethic that says, and so it's our ethical obligation to respect the ethics of other societies. Well, your meta-ethic says our ethical obligation is to respect different views from those societies, even if their ethic is different. So your ethic has suddenly become universal to apply to everybody else, even if they themselves hold a different ethic. So even for a person who's relativistic, the ethic you hold controls your responsibility to others, regardless of what ethic you think they might hold. And those are just a few of the fundamentals that might be there. Those kinds of things determine, if you learn them and you learn how they apply, they determine how you actually solve the problems that we face in a society. So why on earth am I talking about all of this today? Let's put some meat on the bones. You know, let's put some application to it that might reconnect it to the world that you actually live in. And some of you live in the world I was just talking about. So I don't mean to say that in a slighting way. I mean, some of you love the ethical theory and all that kind of stuff, but most of us don't. You know, that it's like not everybody's a car mechanic, right? So not everybody's going to do philosophy and ethical theory. I get that. But we should learn what those basic values are that we hold that determine how we resolve more pressing or current momentary problems that we're trying to trying to deal with. So why am I talking about it today? Let me give you a couple of examples. But both of these examples have to do with the fact that we're spending all of our time as a culture right now trying to improve our harvest. Let's bring world peace. Let's get rid of this divisiveness in the culture. You know, we're trying to do all of these things. On both sides, people say these words, on the conservative side and the liberal side. How do we get rid of this divisiveness, you know, or so on? Or sometimes, how do we get rid of the other half of society, you know, people are saying. We're spending all of our time as a culture trying to improve our harvest after we've already picked it. We're saying these apples aren't good. Let's get better apples. But the trees are already bare. The trees have already fully grown. They're going to produce the kind of fruit they're producing. And yet we think we're going to solve the problem. I've given examples of this in previous episodes. I'll appeal to here very briefly, just so you can understand what I'm trying to get at. On the issue of abortion, we've addressed that. You know, we've looked at the apple that's fallen from the tree. We've said, how do we get a different fruit from this? But we haven't gone all the way back to the seed that we planted over 150 years ago, and maybe more than that, about how we value or don't value children, about how we value or don't value marriage or regard it, or how we regard sexuality and where it fits into reproduction and marriage and so on like that, and divorce and where that fits into all of these questions. We didn't address it then. We didn't address it when we were planting the seeds. And so we're looking at the apple and saying, well, these are not my favorite apples. These are not the galas I was hoping for. And that's a good apple, by the way. And so is a Honeycrisp. There are others. There are others. I'm not trying to be prejudicial here. So we can't even understand how LGBTQ issues, for instance, and abortion relate to each other in earnest, because we don't see how those two things were both going to grow from the same seed that we planted. And if we try to put the genie back in the bottle, you know, if we take that apple and we just, you know, try to inject it with a little extra sugar, you know, or crisp it up in a, I don't know, a cooler or something. So we try to overthrow Roe v. Wade. We'll get rid of that without recognizing the cottage industry of community abortion providers and states who are going to continue to offer abortion as an option, without dealing with what the Atlantic and an Atlantic article that I was reading just recently talked about as the two-thirds of our population doesn't want Roe v. Wade overturned, that means a significant portion of the people who don't want Roe v. Wade overturned also poll as people who do believe abortion is wrong, that it shouldn't be practiced. So if we're not dealing with that, then we're not dealing with the seeds that we planted that caused these sometimes contradictory and sometimes just impossible to resolve dilemmas that are opinions that are in our minds. And we're not properly building, by the way, on the probably equal ratio, close to two-thirds, in the population who do want to make abortion rare at most. We're missing something in our picture of how to solve this problem about the sanctity of human life in the way we're trying to address it. And I'm trying to say that just arguing about the means to get to the solution is never going to get us there. We're going to have to back up and start looking at our basic values and ethics in order to get there. You say, well, that's not going to solve. What's the court supposed to do right now? What's my state supposed to do in the legislature? Fine. People are going to continue to chase that truck down the road. But I'm saying we need to go back to a different intersection and see if there's a different road we should be going down. And the only way you can do that is by backing all the way up to the basis of why we think what we do and starting to address it. And that means starting to think at a deeper level, starting to think about theories. Personal liberties are the same way. And again, I've talked about this on previous episodes. Say, you know, we say we're opposed to big government mandates because it's a government overreach. It's not constitutional. But then we don't mind big government, state, or federal governments reaching around our local ISDs, our local independent school districts, supposedly independent school districts, to mandate things which happen to support our interest. So we don't want, for instance, religious texts or classes banned from schools as believers, and yet we don't want sex ed texts or classes offered in those schools. Even just offered, I'm not talking about mandated, I get it, that's a different matter. We don't even want them offered. We want certain books censored, or vice versa. There are people who don't want religious texts or classes offered in a school, just offered. They don't want them offered, but they don't want sex ed texts or classes banned. It goes both ways. Both groups are doing the same thing, and it's a lack of understanding about where our fundamental commitments lie. What is it we're actually committed to? And so what we need, and this is a very basic inquiry or plea for us to consider taking this more seriously, what we need is to give as much attention to the long game, as some people say it, but I would say give as much attention to the seed we're planting, to the theories in which we're rooting ourselves, as to the day's news, as to the urgency in solving the problem that's right in front of us. That is, we should, and this is a basic for us, and as believers, this should be easy. That is, we should decide first what is right and commit to that, and then start applying it to everything we do.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.